The Lancet Crossbow, featuring patented torsion drive technology, has set the new standard for compact performance. At only 3.9 inches wide, cocked and uncocked, it offers interchangeable fairings, fully housing the toughest, most compact limbs in the archery world. Carbon steel torsion limbs. Lightweight, powerful, and balanced along the frame for superb handling. When cocked, the limbs rotate four cams just 90 degrees, powering the fully suspended pulley system that seamlessly synchronizes timing for extreme precision. Unlike other crossbows that punch vibration into the bolt, torsion drive delivers a 24-inch power stroke that is twice as long, more smoothly and accurately driving velocity. Torsion drive technology gives you the most dependable compact power and accuracy available. Lancehead, the world's first hunting-grade crossbow.
You're in the right place at the right time, and this is The Strangeness, a podcast exploring unsolved mysteries and inexplicable events. My name is Adrian Asahi, your faithful guide into the unknown. Welcome back to the show, everyone! Before we get going, I would like to apologize for the persistent issue with the typo in the show's name and image on some podcast players. I know this means some listeners can't find these episodes, and I understand how frustrating that is. In fact, I'm seeing a negative impact on listener figures. I don't know why some of these massive platforms like Spotify can't sort it out, but I am still reaching out to them about this issue, and so can you. So, please do report it if you get chance. Anyway, with that out of the way, let's dive in. This is part two of our series on missing persons in the US national parks. In this week's episode, I'll be discussing some of the more and less plausible theories relating to the pattern of disappearances and the suspected cover-up that we outlined last week. However, I want to tell you now that I think I may have uncovered information that needs to be shared. Troubling information. I really don't want to say too much, though, at least not until you've listened to some of the people who contacted me with their own experiences over the last several days. In this episode, then, I want you to come on a journey with me, look at the evidence provided by several key witnesses, and then make up your own minds. Personally, taken together, I think that these testimonies have the potential to change everything about this investigation. But I want you to hear it from these witnesses themselves, because this could be big. And if I'm right in my suspicions, it could be really big. So turn off the lights, slip into something comfortable, and maybe even buckle up, because this could be a bumpy ride into the strangeness. Last week, I asked you to send me prospective leads, and you did not disappoint. Sometimes I forget how big this podcast has got over the last few years. You folks have got a broad set of interests, and it was a lot to go through. After the episode aired, I received hundreds of tweets and emails from listeners suggesting cases to look into, potential reasons for these disappearances, and arguments as to why they might have been covered up in the first place by the National Park Service. Some of these were not easy to substantiate. You sent me everything from interesting theories about serial killers and government-sponsored experiments to scary but ultimately unverifiable stories about paranormal entities abducting people from the parks. Honestly, there was a lot to read through. And by Monday morning, I was feeling pretty overwhelmed. So there I was, with my coffee on Monday at 6 a.m, asking myself, where to start? Well, people kept asking me to look into the possibility of serial killers in the parks, and I did. But it quickly became clear that this made no sense. There are thousands of cases that match David Pilates' profile, and these span back more than 150 years, implying a historic series of serial killers, if serial killers are the culprits. Not only that, but occasionally cases have taken place on the same day and in parks on opposite sides of the United States. Therefore, we must consider, for a serial killer hypothesis to make sense, that we would have to entertain the existence of concurrent perpetrators with a shared MO, one that maintains a pattern predating their own births. I looked into this, And such patterns are not only uncommon, they are entirely unprecedented. Having already worked this out, some of you theorized about cartels, secret government experiments, and even satanic death cults. Well, we do know that such things have existed. After all, organized criminals use the parks to grow narcotics, engage in gang warfare, and they're often caught. Likewise, the military have tested on civilians on multiple occasions, as we can learn from the history around Project Edgewood and the infamous MK Ultra. And murderous cults have even been documented in the US and Mexico. You might recall those episodes on which we covered cult leaders like Charles Manson, Adolfo Costanza, and Rock Terrio in the past. But think about the common trends in these particular abductions, documented by Pilates. Just think, if the US government wanted to abduct people for human experimentation, and if cults and cartels wanted to steal people's body parts for sale or for sacrifice, why would they abduct celebrated doctors, wealthy lawyers, fierce athletes, and closely watched children? And why, from the national parks in specific, when there are millions of vulnerable homeless people and undocumented immigrants out there to whom the press have shown a willingness to turn a blind eye? That's sad, but it's true. Just look up the roadside abduction rates for First Nations women in Canada. Furthermore, why would the national parks turn a blind eye to any of these activities, especially when they already arrest people for criminal activity on a regular basis? No, to propose these villains is spurious, to say the least. Because at the same time, none of these suggestions explains the bizarre circumstances surrounding the disappearances we've already covered, like the odd behaviour of search dogs, or the way in which people vanish in company or in areas that no one would have expected anyone to be in the first place. Or indeed, the mysterious return of abductees' possessions, clothes, and the other remains that we talked about last week. Dissatisfied with all of these suggestions, I felt I needed to look for evidence of something less conventional, some reason for which the Park Service might actually want to err on the side of discretion when it comes to these particular cases and their singularly odd details. Like Pilates, I needed an inside perspective. And for that reason, I reached out to the users of a subreddit for National Parks employees. Something nagged at me about the replies I received, and when I read through them a second time, I noticed it. A devil in the details. Scattered throughout were stories with their own strange trend. Because one particular description of a man recurred across several different messages. Messages whose authors had each asked me to look into an unidentified individual associated with a disappearance and fruitless search with which they were personally involved. For now, we'll call him the man in the plaid jacket. Who is the man in the plaid jacket, and why did he stand out here? Well, rather than listen to me, let me read you the message I received from one search and rescue professional who goes only by Kyle. And as he wasn't available to comment himself, I've attempted to give him some character, so you'll have to put up with my accent. But look past it, at the details, and perhaps you'll see what piqued my interest.
Dear Adrian, this is Kyle from Reddit. I don't want to give out my full name, so thanks for letting me do this anonymously. Let me start up top. I work in search and rescue in a national park. I'm not comfortable saying which one, but we're East Coast, down south on the Appalachian Trail. Like a lot of people in my line of work, I know about David Pilates and his books, and I know he's written about some cases in my region. To be upfront, I have worked on a lot of cases, and usually it's an accident when someone goes missing, and thank God we do normally find the person. All the same, Pilates has written about a few cases that either me or the guys in my team have worked on at one time or another. And, well, I know it sounds weird, but there's this guy who we've all seen on those cases. And none of us knows who he is. Let me start up. People like me like solving mysteries and all that. It's why a lot of us get into search and rescue work, but, well, we was talking one time and we noticed that we'd all run into this guy around particular search efforts in the region, and that none of us knows what he does or who he works for. So, he turns up in town around the same time that someone goes missing, and the odd thing about it, we realized, is that we've only ever seen him on cases where we never found a body. So, when me and the boys checked, when we worked out which disappearances this guy turned up at, they was all ones in books by David Pilates. I mean, none of us has ever seen this guy on a normal case, not once. Just those unsolved ones. I can give you a general description. He's burly, about 6'3" in boots, maybe 200 pounds, maybe 210. And he's dressed like a normal guy from around here. A white dude, big black beard. Got a plaid jacket on and no uniform, but he turns up right around the same time as the cops. Sometimes you see him talking to them. He's always in a big black SUV, and to be sure, we've all just run into him around the site during cases that ended up in those books. I don't know if it's some sort of undercover cop or what, I don't know, but I thought it might be useful for you to know about, seeing as you're looking into it for your podcast. I haven't heard of your show, but we listen to Rogan all the time, so if you send me a link, I'll put you on instead. I'd love to know if you find anything out, but that's about it, so good luck. Kyle.
Sorry for the rusty voice work, but I assure you I was reading from the original document. And either way, don't you think that message was strange? I think so. But it seems a lot stranger when you consider that I also received 3 other emails like this, all mentioning a bearded man in plaid. One came from a dog handler in Yellowstone National Park who claimed that she had noticed a man of this description brought in to observe a handful of search efforts in her region since 1997. Strangely though, those occasions were the only 3 on which her dogs ever refused to follow the scent of a missing person. Another email was sent by a Parks Police receptionist in the Kanisku National Forest, who told me that a man in a black vehicle, in plain clothes, and specifically a plaid overcoat, had appeared at her station to meet with Parks management after 2 separate disappearances, both of which made their way into Pilates' books. And then the third, and perhaps most worrying message, came from Laurie, a barman at a roadside cafe on the edge of the Comanche Peak, only a few miles from the place where Jared Atadero disappeared. Laurie claims to have served the same bearded man dressed in plaid on several occasions. He said that the man was memorable not only because of his large blacked-out truck, but also because he had arrived in town around the time of several disappearances. Not afterwards, though. Rather, every time, at least 1 full day in advance. Now I know what you're thinking, and yes, I followed these emails up to prove that the senders really were who they said they were. At last then, a trail I could pursue. So, there I was by midweek, my best lead, a suspicious individual with distinct habits and connections, it seemed, to the park service. A man in plaid, seen in the area of multiple disappearances, sometimes even before their event. Armed with this data, I turned to Twitter to gather more information, in specific, about the man in plaid. For anyone who didn't see my tweet, I asked, "Have you ever seen a man in plaid behaving oddly in a national park? Send me your stories. Give me an approximate date and location. Describe the man in detail and tell me what he was doing." Cryptic, I know, but I didn't want to give too much away. Despite the typo, we've gained a lot of followers lately, and I had a lot of responses. But there was nothing substantial. That was, until I saw one that simply read, "I'm a big fan of your show, but I also think that my sister has a national parks experience that you might find interesting. I've asked her to get in touch with you about a man wearing plaid, strange creatures, and a cover-up in the national parks. Please look out for an email from C. I checked and there was nothing. But later that day, I received the inbox notification. The message was titled, "I was asked to email you about my experience." And it was signed by a woman called Claire. I want to be completely frank with you. What came out of this email is shocking. It set me on a new path, and I don't think it makes any sense for me to simply describe it here. Instead, I think that you should experience it as I did, listening to the person who sent it. Her name is Claire, and the things she saw while taking photographs in a national park in California in the 1980s are eye-opening, to say the least. I won't lie, I didn't know what to make of this story when Claire emailed it through. Nonetheless, I wanted to check her credentials, to interview her and to get a full sense of this. And then when I did, the details she provided were too much to overlook. So, I think that the most sensible thing that I could do here is to play that interview for you, complete and unabridged, and then to discuss it and to consider its implications. Claire, thank you so much for speaking to me. To clarify this, your brother put you in touch with me, but this is your personal experience, which happened in California in a national forest back in 1989? And I know we've already discussed this, but could you tell my listeners what you were doing there at the time?
I was working over there. I'd just joined a software company, fairly big software company. And prior to that, I'd been at working for an American investment bank. And I was out on a secondment to their offices in Mountain View by Big Sur Forest.
If you would, and I know you're not comfortable about this, so thanks. Would you just sort of walk us into this from the beginning of your experience in the park?
So I went there in the afternoon, probably about 3:30, 3:45, parked the car up. There is a trail that's quite an open trail. It's more like a path that goes down to a beach and probably about 1/2 mile to 1 mile from the parking area. It was great. There's a load of rocks on the far side. So I wandered up there, sat down, I got my camera bag with me, and I looked over to the way I would need to go back. And there were, I thought, first of all, it was a huge cat, but it was much more big and bulky than a cat. And then there was more than one of them as they came round the promontory. And I have never seen anything like it in my life. Very, very large, very hairy, moving on all fours. And there were several of these creatures, one behind the other. It obviously wasn't a cat because it popped up. It stood up on 2 feet and it was bipedal. Must have been 7 to 8 foot tall. It was followed in onto this cove by two other 5 to 6 foot, maybe just over 6.5 foot, and three much smaller ones. And probably like the idiot I am, I just thought, well, no one's going to believe this. I'll take some photographs of it. So lifted the camera up to take photographs. Part of the lens kit dropped off, hit the rocks, went bouncing down where I was sat, and every one of them snapped round and was staring toward me, at which point the male that was in the water basically was up to its, I'd say, mid-chest in the water, came striding out of the water. One of the females, the larger one of the two females, came after it. And probably about 30 yards or so away from me, they had an argument. They were screaming at each other in gibberish. The male that was in front it was verbalizing with her. It sounded like a language, and they were chuntering away back and forwards, back and forwards, back and forwards. And it was like a couple having a domestic dispute. Then the body turned right back at me, and it just screamed. It was like no other sound I've ever heard. It was bellowing at me. It threw down and slammed its fists into the sand. I was feeling incredibly sick. Last thing I remember was this thing, mouth wide open, and I'm presuming I passed out.
So what happened next?
Well, what happened next is I come to about 20, 30 yards back from where my car is parked. I was dressed in hiking boots, jeans. I had a shirt on underneath, and I had a wax cotton jacket. This was actually almost pulled over my head. And you see, I can't understand how I got there. I was black and blue up my left-hand side, and my face was very badly scratched and bruised. I could have got there. I just don't understand how I got there, because I can't remember getting there. I hadn't got my camera. I hadn't got my camera bag. I just don't know. I got the keys that were in my zipper pocket, in my breast zipper pocket, got back into the car, drove to the hotel, and the young man that was doing the valet parking went and got someone. They obviously thought I'd been assaulted. I wasn't making any much sense. So they put me in a side room and called the police.
Can you tell us what happened when the police arrived, particularly who you spoke to?
First of all, there was one guy. He just wanted me to run through it, everything that had happened. And I did. And he sat there and looked at me. The first thing was, he was saying, have I been drinking? Was I on drugs? Obviously, I was very young to hold the business position I did. He was quite incredulous until I got the business cards out. And he was just being, to my mind, incredibly rude and obnoxious by this point. So then he asked me to go through everything again. And by this time, another chap joined him. Now, the first man was in uniform. The second man wasn't. And if he was a police officer, well, I've never seen a police officer like him.
And how would you describe him, the second man that arrived?
He had jeans on, plaid, white T-shirt underneath that.
Plaid. Fascinating. Did he have any distinct features?
He was in his early mid 40s, very, very wiry pepper hair.
Beard?
Big beard. Didn't say anything, just stood at the back of the room and listened to what I had to say. Went through the whole thing again. And the man said, well, what you obviously saw was bears. You'll be very, very lucky. You know, you're lucky to be alive. Obviously, you know, you just concussion and you've staggered back up to the car. But I know what a bear looks like, and there is no way on this planet that what I saw were bears. And I was quite adamant about that fact with him.
How did he take that?
He read me the Riot Act, and what I saw had been bears, and I wasn't to say anything to anyone else other than it was bears. And I again turned around and said, absolutely not. And he said, do you not have police in your country? And it was, well, yes, we do. I said, but they don't tell you what to write in statements. And he just looked at me and said, do you understand English? I said, well, I am English, actually. I understand it very, very well. Thank you. And he said, you're not to discuss this with anyone. We've taken your report, and you're not to go back there. And that was that. And that pretty much, that was the end of it. I stayed in the hotel over Sunday. I still felt incredibly sick. I cancelled my visit to Madison. I was due to fly up there on the Monday, and I flew home instead on the Tuesday.
I don't blame you. There's a detail that's nagging at me, though. When you passed out, you were on the beach. So how did you get back to your car?
Truthful answer is, I don't know. Do I think I was? I think I was dumped there. If I had walked and stumbled, I would have had marks on both knees, my hands. My hands were pretty much not damaged. It was the back of my hands that was scratched, and it was the side of my face. And I think I was dragged there. I think I was dragged there and dumped.
Claire, I'm really sorry to take you back to it again, but these are remarkable claims. So can you describe those creatures in any more detail?
As I said, the one was definitely male. They were mammals. The females had shorter hair than the male, and the males had round its face. It had longer hair. The chest was not as hairy, but it was like a very, very large, very fit bodybuilder. Massive muscles on either side of its head. The arms were slightly longer and very, very long-fingered. It looked apish, thin lips. It had flat teeth like us, but very large canines, black eyes. The other thing that I, you know, in hindsight, it's fascinating. They were definitely verbal. They were communicating with each other. They were in conversation with each other. It sounded like a language that you could almost understand, but you couldn't. I think in the email I called it gibberish, and it would when one would finish speaking to the other, it would go. And the other one, they were just back and forward, back and forward, back and forward.
It sounds like that stuck with you. Would you say it sounded anything like this?
Yeah, that's it.
Absolutely incredible. I thought it might be. You see, I took the liberty of doing a bit of research of my own, and I found that audio from someone called Ron Moorhead. He researches these sorts of things and claims to have recorded creatures like the ones you've described in California, like you, but in Yosemite National Park in the 1970s. The similarities are unnerving. So what happened after that?
That was pretty much that, like I said, after they finished having their domestic, the male turned around as he was at full height, screamed, and just smashed his fist into the ground, and that and the scream, and I was very much bye-byes, yeah.
Claire, what would you say these things you saw are?
They were bipedal primate stroke hominids that are not classified. More than that, I don't know, but they are verbal. So they're obviously intelligent. They were working together as a team. They were communicating together. And I have never seen anything like it. I hope I never see anything like it again. I didn't know what to think.
Could I ask you how this affected you? Did it affect you?
How did it affect me? Well, one sort of funny codicil to the whole experience, thinking about it, was many, many years later, I continued to work in IT, and I was working a lot with government clients over here and military and such like. And they obviously check your background, do what they do, meet with friends, family to ask questions about you. And then you get interviewed and you have the usual questions, you know, would you take money for selling company secrets? Have you ever stolen from anyone? Have you had an affair? Have you used prostitutes? La, la, la. So I was going through the interview with this chap. And after about 10 minutes, he said, and have you ever seen a Bigfoot? So, yeah, there we are.
Fascinating. Almost like they knew. Like someone had spoken about it. Did you tell anyone about this?
after 30-odd years, because this was 1989, apart from my brother, you're the only person I've spoken to about it since.
Thus ended my interview with Claire. And I suppose there's no other way to say it. After that conversation, I found myself balanced on the threshold of a world I had not expected to stumble into. The mysterious and often sinister world of Bigfoot conspiracy cover-ups. I know that this is probably contentious for some of you, but I have to say that I've always been open to the idea of Sasquatch and all that. After all, I grew up watching Leonard Nimoy's show In Search of Myths and Monsters, and I do try to keep an open mind. And of course, if you listen to this show, then you know that I think there are many things we don't understand about our world. But Bigfoot abducting people, I mean, is it far-fetched? Or is it really that far-fetched? After all, when you review the things we already know, people clearly do go missing in strange numbers in wilderness areas that have long been protected. Protected since Teddy Roosevelt declared them national parks. And hang on a minute. Didn't Roosevelt claim himself to have seen a wild man, hairy and 8 foot tall, prior to his creation of the parks? A little Google research reveals that he did, and that he published that story in his memoirs, which you can still buy and read today. I'll try to post the extract in the case notes for this episode. And similarly, the Native American and First Nations peoples indigenous to the US and Canada have, I found out, many myths of their own spanning the vast diversity of their tribal cultures, all agreeing on the existence of such creatures, and often painting them as thieves of women, children, and men who travel the wilder forests and mountains alone. They have also been said to take the clothes from their abductees. And that mythology goes back thousands of years. That same folklore makes it clear also that dogs will not pursue them, and that such is their stealth that these creatures are able to vanish at will, becoming one with their very surroundings. Aboriginal legends, and, it turns out, many, many modern accounts, have them gift items for humans to find in exchange for that which they take. And, sometimes, they are also said to return the possessions of those who they take. I believe Claire. If I didn't, I wouldn't have played her account on the show. But do I think that the things she saw are responsible for the events documented by Pylades? I want to say no. But I can't say that with conviction. Because of course, these stories share a common feature. The appearance of the bearded man dressed in plaid. Recall that Claire claims to have been threatened by someone who matched the very description given by search and rescue professionals and park residents in connection with multiple strange disappearances. A man quite obviously involved in these cases somehow, and now also with the suppression of information pertaining to Bigfoot. I needed advice before I felt that I could pursue this prospective conspiracy. So, I reached out to someone with a good reputation and a celebrated catalogue of work on the topic of these mysterious creatures. Wes Germer runs a popular podcast called Sasquatch Chronicles, where he gives time to people who claim to have run into these creatures themselves. After having had his own traumatic encounter in the early 2000s, he takes a gentle approach to interviews, interrogating lightly but mostly giving his guests a safe platform from which to discuss their own experiences. I reached out to him then, asking if he'd ever heard of a connection between Pylades, Bigfoot, and this mysterious man in plaid. And I was not disappointed with his response. The full interview is about 40 minutes, and I can make this available on Patreon. Here, though, I'll play some key extracts. For instance, I asked Wes about Claire's run-in with the park's police.
You know, you tend to hear that a lot with encounters Generally, it's people who have evidence or if they were hurt, where it's always a cop and or some sort of law enforcement person and this other guy. And I think their job is to shut you up, you know, to make you be quiet and to let you know you saw a bear and don't go back down there. I mean, this happens more than you would think. And so I truly believe there is a effort to conceal this from the public.
So you think there's merit to the idea of a cover-up?
This is definitely being covered up. And again, I think when you get hurt or if you have evidence, you're probably going to get a visit from these guys. And because there's proof to what you're saying. You're walking away with something. And it's very consistent to what you said. There's always one guy in a uniform who's obvious law enforcement. And then there's a second guy. Now, the second guy seems to be in charge. And he's not dressed in any sort of uniform. He's, you know, like how you described him, jeans, beard, you know, shirt, looked like he walked off the street. And generally those guys are the ones who are actually in charge.
So do you have any idea who they might be, who this man in plaid is?
I think those guys are government contractors. And I say that because I think eventually when this comes out, there's deniable, the government can deny they knew anything about it. Probably sounds crazy to the audience, but I've had some time to think about this. And I think when they show up, again, it's because you have evidence or someone got hurt and they have to shut you up. And I know I sound like Alex Jones, but I've heard so many things about these guys off the air. And I wish it's so ridiculous they go with that argument that, you know, it's a bear, it's a bear, it's a bear. It generally just pisses witnesses off when these guys show up and do that. You would think they would use a different tactic when dealing with people.
But as far as the government knowing about them, there's no doubt in my mind the government knows about them. I mean, I can bring encounter after encounter after encounter.
We went on to discuss relationships between these individuals, strange disappearances, and Bigfoot.
You always hear about people disappearing when they're walking down trails. It's always a guy that's too far ahead of the group or the guy that falls behind. I mean, you hear a lot of missing people cases that way where they just vanish. They're just gone and they're never heard from again. And people are like, yeah, he was just behind me about, you know, 100 feet and he was gone.
Yet it seems like these guys are connected to it.
I would agree.
Do you have any idea why they would do this? I mean, you see these stories about logging rights being infringed on if they come out with it, or about protecting them as a species, but... what do you think, Wes? What's your position on it?
And we're going to cut to commercial. No, I'm just joking.
You know, I mean, it could be, it's hard to say, you know, at the end of the day, who cares what I think? I'm hard pressed to believe that it's a natural animal we haven't caught up with. I just don't buy it. I think that there's something else going on, and I think they cover it up. And it goes directly back to outside of money, outside of lumber, outside of everything else. It goes back to what these things are. That's why they cover it up. And I think it goes back to that. So I'm hard pressed to say it's a natural animal. But like I said, at the end of the day, man, who cares what I think?
Wes was astonishingly humble. And he seemed entirely sincere. A far cry from the typical media portrait of a conspiracy theorist. As well, everything he said made sense. And to my surprise, I found myself drawn fully into a strange world in which it seemed normal to conclude that monsters are real, be they ape men or government agencies protecting some terrible secret. Something they deem it worth suppressing at the expense of ordinary people and the families of those who fall victim to whatever is responsible for these strange deaths. But this was no cosmic horror, no story pulled from the pages of Lovecraft or Hodgson or Chambers. No, this was real life. It is real life. And if these terrible suggestions can be confirmed, then the people that govern our lives may truly be lying to us about a lot more than unexplained deaths in the mountains and forests of America. What have I uncovered, listeners? And at the end of this, our second installment in the series, what can I conclude? The truth is, I don't yet know. All I know thus far is that strange disappearances occur and that they're well documented, whether the authorities like it or not. That the remains return to us at times and in manners which suggest the intervention of someone or something which seeks to leave us a message. I know that a man in plaid has been seen at the site of many such vanishings, and that he also has been described as an oppressor by people who have, themselves, encountered strange things in the vast American wilderness. I know that there are amaranthine legends about creatures which take people in these places, and where I would once have been inclined to suggest that those stories were a poetic way to explain the mystery at hand, that presumption has been disturbed by modern accounts in which men who claim to represent the government appear to have conspired against those regular people who have stumbled upon the existence of such creatures. Are Sasquatch responsible for these disappearances? Let me be upfront with you, listeners. I don't know. But right now, as strange as that hypothesis is, it's the best lead I have. And between this and next week's episode, I want to get to the bottom of it. More to the point, I want to find someone who can connect me to this man in plaid. I have so many questions I'd like to ask him, if only I could pin him down. And thus, I must conclude part 2 of our series on missing persons in the national parks of North America. And by the way, I apologize for the literary tone tonight. I know it's like Marmite because I read all of your lovely comments. But this week, the script felt like it warranted a dose of cosmic horror. And after all, we do seem to be dealing with something beyond the field of our present knowledge. But together, I hope that you and I can travel to its borders. Well, I hope you enjoyed the show tonight, folks. If you salivate at the idea of additional content, I have a buffet for you over at Patreon. Lock in those lower fees for the rest of the month. And if you want to become a member of the website, head on over. You may have noticed that I'm in the process of divorcing Gmail at the moment. Can't say I like the idea of Google reading all the hate mail I'm going to get after this episode. No, the Google algorithm scans through your mail, and I'm not really very comfortable with it reading my private mail, so... Anyway, we have a new contact portal on the website, so please use that if you'd like to get in touch, especially if you can put me in touch with a mysterious man in plaid. And please, please do check out our very appropriate sponsor tonight, especially if you're going for a hike in a national park. Lancehead sent me a beautiful crossbow along with their commercial. And I have to say, I have absolutely no use for it here in Shropshire yet. But it does feel fucking fantastic to have around the house. And after all, you never do know what's out there in the dark. So to wrap it up for tonight, folks, thank you so much for listening. Thank you as well to Claire and to everybody else who sent information or spoke on the show tonight. I wouldn't be able to do this without you. I've been Adrian Asahi, your faithful guide into the unknown. You've been listening to The Strangeness. So to wrap it up, folks, stay safe. Stay well, and most of all, stay strange. Just chipping in with a little addendum to say, I know these shows have dealt with some material and themes and topics that we don't normally cover, especially around conspiracy theory culture, so thank you so much for bearing with. It's unexplored territory for me as well. And also the typo, I'm very sorry about that, and I do look forward to getting it fixed as soon as possible. I hope it's not impeded you on your journey to find these episodes. Thank you for listening, and see you all next week.